Hey, that's about it for me. Time is running out. Mike's on his way to jump on this. So, take care of yourself. My name is Juan Flores. This has been Jazz Latino. Back with you next Thursday at 11 a.m. Take care of yourself. Let's start some weekend.
KPFT, Houston.
Tear down that bitch of a fairy wall and put a window where it ought to be.
You gotta ask me nicely.
Down the rabbit hole. See you there. Thursdays, 2 to 3 p.m. on KPFT 90.1 HD3. It's Weltanschauung. Take a trip with me and explore what's out there. Good afternoon. All right, let me just fix that microphone there. You are tuned in to Weltanschauung on KPFT HD3, the Big Fun 901, broadcasting from downtown Montrose in Houston, Texas. We are community funded, community sponsored, supported radio. That means you listening out there in the ethosphere make it possible for us to reach you via the magic of radio and the internet through your generous donations to the station. And so, if you pledged during our recent fund drive, please make sure to make good on that pledge by sending in your donations to keep us going strong. That said, a couple of weeks ago, I came across an interesting development in biocybernetics. And, well, there were a group of scientists who have constructed a tiny swimming biomechanical hybrid, a biobot, if you will, by splicing heart cells and connective tissue cells onto a flexible polymer so that it was able to propel itself through a fluid environment, much like a sperm cell does. And with no more ado, I am going to introduce our guest for today, and he is here to tell us more about this. And his name is Tahir Saif. He's a professor of biomechanics at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. And Tahir, it is great to have you on today. How you
Thank
doing?
You.
There we go. Well, I tell you what, why don't we start from the beginning? And I don't know if we should start with the impetus of developing this or how you made it. Why don't we, what brought you into looking at this sort of aspect of creating biohybrids, and we'll go from there.
Okay. Very glad to be at your show. The idea was, can we have swimmers that could do some function for us? For example, delivering drugs at the right site, if you will, or maybe swim in the environment to take out some toxins or let us know that there are toxins, just like many, many bacteria do inside our body as well as in the environment. So we realized that this micro world, which has this small flagella or cilia that bacteria use, bacteria uses to move from one place to the other, we couldn't find anything similar to that that people have done before and engineered them. What we found was the small-scale swimmers that could swim by an external electric field or magnetic field. So people made little screw-shaped magnets that if you could turn in a fluid by an external magnetic field, they would turn and propel in the fluid just like you drive a screw in a wall. Or people have made magnetic flagella. They're made of magnetic beads connected to each other by DNA or some flexible wires. And if you apply an external magnetic field, they would wag like a tail and they would swim. So we thought that, well, can we make something like a sperm that does not need any external field? They are autonomous. They know where to go and how to swim. It's all self-contained. So we thought, well, how can we achieve this without any external work done on them? Well, one solution was to use some living cells, contractile living cells, like heart cells that drive our hearts. Now, the question is, how could we use these living cells, cardiomyocytes or heart cells, which are not trained to swim? So we thought, well, how about putting them on a just a fine, flexible wire, like a polymer wire, like you mentioned. And it turns out that these cells land on these wires, and they bend the wire, just like the sperm does on their flagella. And then this bending of the wire creates a flagellar-type motion, or like a tail being wagged. And if they're let free, we find them swimming in the fluid, which is the media that supports the cell, cell food and so on, nutrition and so on. So that's where we started, essentially to create a living swimmer, but engineered based on some simple structure like a wire. And we showed that it is such a swimmer can be constructed.
Yeah.
And they could swim in a fluid. They could swim for days.
Oh, that's now that is very important in the fact of the longevity, you know, the reliability, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to kind of delve in a little bit about how the pieces of the puzzle as far as construction goes. It sounds kind of like a kit in a sense that you've got a couple of types of cells, some fibroblasts, connective mm-hmm. tissue cells, and some heart cells that actually the beauty of heart cells, cardiomyocytes, technically speaking, is that they have their own intrinsic rhythm in that mm-hmm. they beat, and this let's say just a standard I can't remember what the rhythmicity of the cells in and of themselves are, but let's just say 60 beats per minute, standard heartbeat. They beat in a rhythmical fashion, and that clock cycle within themselves, that beating cycle, allows the cells to contract and relax, contract and relax, contract and relax, and so you have this sort of ability to create motion. And, just give us a little synopsis of the construction with the fibroblasts, the cardiomyocytes, and sticking them in strategic spots in this flexible polymer. And, let's examine that.
Sure. The thing is, first we need to make the wire, the polymer wire, to give you an idea of the size scale of the wire. So they are, in terms of their width or diameter, they are about, 10 micrometers, which is one-tenth the diameter of human hair, our hair. They are about a millimeter or a couple of millimeters long, so you couldn't see by naked eye. They're very, very small, just because they're so skinny. If wire diameter becomes one-tenth our diameter, our eye couldn't pick up.
Mm-hmm.
So the way we make it is we etch out a channel in a silicon wafer, which is a standard technique for making electronics. So we make a channel, and we take liquid polymer, and if you put the liquid polymer near this channel, then the channel gets filled up by the polymer.
Fascinating. Let me just, yes. I just have to interrupt. It's almost like creating a micromold, correct?
Correct, absolutely. It's a micromold.
Yeah. Oh, beautiful.
So this micromold, because of its size, has an additional functionality. If you think of filling a glass tube in a water, many of us have played when we were kids, is if you put a glass pipette in water, you might have seen the water rushing up.
Capillary action,
exactly. So if the glass tube was a big tube, then you would not see the capillary action as much. But narrower they are, the higher the rise of the water. That's how the trees transport liquid from the ground to the top of the tree. So smaller these channels are, which in this case, in our case, is very small, as I said, about 10 microns in width. So if you put a droplet of this polymer nearby, they just suck the polymer into the channel. So we're not really filling manually. It's done automatically. So once the channel gets filled, we cure the polymer, just raising the temperature to about 60, 70 degrees, and leave it for a day.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes solid now. And then we take it out from the channel. Now it's like a solid wire. And once that is done, we put a material which is adhesive to the cell. So let's say it's kind of a cell glue. A more technical name is fibronectin.
Kind of a constituent of a biological constituent of a basement membrane, a foundation.
Correct.
Yes,
that's right. So once we put it near the end of this, let's say one end is the head, the other end is the tail end. So if you put this glue near one end of the tail, then it is now ready to attach cells. And once that is done, we take these cardiac cells or cardiomyocytes and fibroblasts from rat heart, and there are standard techniques of extraction of those cardiomyocytes and fibroblasts from rat heart, and that we put onto the onto this tail structure, and it takes about a day for the cells to really settle down and attach to that glue, as I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And the cardiomyocytes begin to beat and begin to bend this wire. And the interesting thing is that once they begin to bend the wire, you can imagine as if like you're some contractile muscle is attached to a flexible wire. When you contract, you can imagine this wire gets bent a little bit, right?
Yes, yes.
So when this begins to happen, the cells sort of begin to feel which direction to beat such that the bending is maximized. So then they begin to cluster, they begin to talk to each other, they begin to talk to the wire in a way, and then they organize themselves into a little cluster, such that this cluster becomes like a motor, becomes like an actuator.
And I'm sorry, go ahead. I was going to interrupt because it gets my mind just rolling and exciting and, about the construction aspect. And yeah, I know, don't want to get, stay too long on that, but I just have to, ask.
Sure.
Let's go to the lab. And I'm imagining you're in the lab, and
uh-huh.
You've got this flexible polymer that
mm-hmm.
has a sort of a weighted or a head area, a wider area,
right?
Followed by a thinner tail and a and that allows it to be flexible and movable and allows a sort of propulsion motion. And let's say you have. Maybe a lot of our listeners may remember watching a film, a little short clip, let's say a few decades ago, of actually taking a micro pipette and extracting a nucleus of a cell and stuff out of a cell in and of itself. And let's say
right.
we're using an instrument like that.
Mm-hmm.
To lay down fibronectin around the junction of the head and the tail so that the cells would be attracted to it and
right.
conglomerate around that area and
mm-hmm.
therefore begin to communicate with each other and
mm-hmm.
Create a synchronous beat around that area. And there you have it. You have
That's
a
right.
swimming motile creature.
Right, right. So once it starts to bend, it's like wagging a tail. And that bending or just wagging the tail, the bending part sort of goes from this part where you are wagging the tail towards the end of the tail. And that's what drives the swimmer. So once you let it go, the cardiomyocytes keep beating, it keeps generating the sort of the bending wave, the wagging tail, and that wagging or the bending keeps on going from the actuation side to the end of the tail, and as it moves down the tail, the liquid or the media around it pushes it towards
yes.
the forward direction.
So you have
and
to
there you go.
Yes,
it then begins to swim. That's exactly what the sperm does.
And therefore, you have directionality.
Therefore, you have directionality, precisely.
Yes.
It's heading towards the head, just like the sperm heads towards the head.
You know, I love to absorb You know, and I would consider myself definitely a layman in this area, but I love to absorb the information and the possibilities that spring forth out of that and try to go in my own different direction. And let's say, yes, okay, potentials for minimally invasive surgery or delivery of drugs. And in a sense, I, as a student of the medical field, for the past 30 years, there are potential problems with, immune reactions and thromboembolism and all of that stuff. But I think, wait a minute, what has nobody, what is not particularly thought of in the field? And I think of, well, this has a lot to do with self-assembly, in the sense that the cells themselves assembled on their own around this junction. And I was thinking about architecture. And I know, you know, and that I love to throw a wrench in the works. And I'm thinking, well, architecture and the fact of, okay, so you have assemblage of this structure.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this motile device, and the fact of, well, building from the bottom up, architecturally speaking, with all kinds of potentials for that is the ability to react with the environment in and of itself, and auto self-assemblage in a exponential doesn't, I don't know if that fits or not, but it, self-assemblage in an exponential sense as far as architecture goes, and maybe programming these things to and I guess the word that comes to my mind is to coagulate and assemble and to be able to build structures in and of themselves. That is, the cells build the little swimming device, and the swimming devices conglomerate in various sorts of architectural structures. And that is a very interesting potential that I think deserves some scrutiny there.
Absolutely. I think you hit the nail in the right spot, because, you know, this is sort of the very early foundation, let's say a brick of the whole building, where but an important brick, which tells us that, look, if we make a very elementary tail, and if you could give a space in the tail where the cells would attach, then let it grow by itself. This sort of a self-assembly batch fabrication. Let me go backward a little bit. If you think about how electronics came into being, we talk about batch fabrication all the time. The reason why the computers become cheaper every day is because we can pack more and more circuits in smaller and smaller places. And we do this fabrication in a batch mode. We make thousands and hundreds of thousands of them all at the same time, which makes it very, very cheap. Cheap per unit cost of the product. In this case, we can make the wires in a batch mode. So, for example, in a small die, you can have hundreds of thousands of them.
Yes.
So that's the batch fabrication part that we have learned over the last 50 years. What we are learning anew here is the self-assembly that you have been emphasizing for your audience, which is critical in this case. When we have this bottom-up engineered batch fabricated tails, and then we put the cells on top, now we are up to the nature to see what happens. Right?
Yes.
We don't have any more control.
Yes, yes.
So now it's a new mode of manufacturing where the cells come in, and a priori, we don't know what they're going to do. All you provided them is a room to stay whether they will come to your house. When they come to your house, in the room you provided, will they work together or will they kill themselves? We don't know. But it turns out that they kind of like each other.
And beautiful.
And by liking and sticking to the room, they sort of change the room as well, such that the room becomes more useful. So this part we have no control on. Here, this particular case where the cells landing and liking it, attaching it, self-organizing it, is really relying on millions of years of evolution.
Yes, yes.
Millions of years of the way cells have evolved.
Yes.
So
yes.
It just happened that they sort of like it. And now if you think of having many, many of these tails offering these rooms, cells landing in, you end up with having many, many of these swimmers. And looking beyond is if we could go from cardiomyocytes to more programmed cells that could swim when there is a need for swimming, or when they contract, there is a signal for which they contract.
Yes.
Then we are in a much bigger business.
And, you know, I remember catching a little blurb about weaving in neuronal cells or nerve cells into that, and I was thinking, well, what about, and a lot of this has to do with a sort of taxis towards a particular point, where and I was thinking chemotaxis, and there is a lot to be said with using various types of cellular receptors and somehow splicing that into, be it the cardiomyocytes themselves or fibroblasts, or splicing a cell, a leukocytic sort of hybrid cell into that, in the sense of chemotaxis, without the, because I'm not sure you know, I guess you have to go to the lab and see what's more robust, a nerve cell or a leukocyte. And they both have their pluses and minuses. But on a rudimentary molecular genetic level, as far as the beginning goes, shouldn't that be a part of the investigation as far as looking at the particular cell surface receptors and chemotaxis, in the sense that, well, a normal, let's say, inflammatory cell like a leukocyte would be more apt to respond to on a more basic level, no?
Right, right. These are very, very good ideas, and I think they need significant attention. I think this is sort of the general direction we are heading as well. So all the issues that you're raising are now worth investigating. The robustness, the type of cells that should be on board on the swimmers, the type of cell adhesives or cell receptors that we should put on these tails, depending on what we want to do with these swimmers.
Yes.
These issues would be all on the table.
You know, and
future usage.
You also created, I guess, in late 2012, there was also a paper published of not only swimmers, but you've got some walking biobots.
Right. That's also from the University of Illinois. The lead author of that paper was Professor Rashid Bashir, and I was the one of the co-authors of the paper. So, yes, in that paper, we used similar cardiomyocytes, and we put them on a soft platform, and when the cardiomyocytes get together, they beat again in synchrony. We see them walking sort of on a substrate, just like you would see in many bugs walk on substrates. Again, that was done in the spirit of creating biological machines that would take you from one place to the other by walking mode. And the later paper was for the swimming mode. So the general idea is very similar. If we can have some live cells propelling these machines, then we can take the next step of using them for carrying payloads to do, you know, chemotactics, a variety of things depending on the need of the question.
Yeah, the field is wide open. And just as a closing thought, none of this could have been done, at least in as far as I know, none of this could have been done without funding for basic science research that you're doing, which is a wonderful thing, without the National Science Foundation.
Right, absolutely. I mean, this I should definitely mention, and I'm very glad that you brought it up, is that, you know, both the work that you mentioned, the walking as well as the swimmer, we have been graciously funded by National Science Foundation Center. We have a center that has three major institutions in the U.S. One is the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. The other one is the MIT. And the third one is Georgia Institute of Technology. So we are about, let's say, about 30 investigators involving another 60 graduate students and postdocs. And the whole idea of this center is to develop biological machines as a hybrid between living and engineered structures that perform functions which have a lot more complexity, diversity, and intelligence compared to the machines that we use today. So in a way, this center is creating a whole new field. Hopefully, in the next 10, 20 years, we'll see a whole new generation of machines that is somewhat of a living machines for a variety of activities. Professor Roger Kam of MIT is the lead investigator of this whole center. And without the support from the National Science Foundation, which is supported by your listeners, from your taxpayers,
yes,
from your tax money.
Yes, very, very well spent, I must say. And, you know, we've just barely scratched the surface, and
right,
we've got, you know, and is in this conversation, it looks like we've come to the closing of this particular topic, and it's I say that with regret, because we just barely scratched the surface of what's going on right now. But I definitely want to thank you for coming on, and we gotta have you back on it at a future date to go in a little deeper in this. But it's just right now, it's just to get folks' feet wet about what is going on in the field of basic science, and definitely something, a well worth endeavor that, you know, where this is going to take us is up to us. And there is so much potential. And Tahir Saif, I thank you so much for coming on, and you know, we got to have you back on in the future to go in further detail. I hope you can come back on soon.
That would be my pleasure. Thank you very much, Mike.
And I thank you for having me, and I thank you for coming on, and we will catch you catch up on this at a later date sometime this year.
Okay. Very good, then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. See you on the flip side.
Yeah. Bye.
Tuned in to KPFT 90.1 HD3. The show is Welton Sean. I'm your host, Mike DeLeonardis. And from biomechanical devices, biobots, which interestingly enough have as a component of their construction, a particular sort of, fabrication that relies on a sort of manufacturing process not too dissimilar of the manufacturing process of, microelectronics. And so it's an interesting segue into our next topic of MEMs, which stands for microelectromechanical systems. And I caught something a couple of weeks ago that has developed a lot of excitement in the media, as well as the scientific community, regarding micro windmills and energy generation. And we're going to explore this area, this new area of MEMs, MEMS, microelectromechanical systems, and to help me and to help us understand this a little bit better is my next guest, J.C. Chow, professor of electromechanical and bioengineering at UT Southwestern and UT Arlington. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you, J.C., to the show. And, why don't you start off and tell us exactly what microelectromechanical systems are and, how they're made in a sort of general sense?
Yes. Hi, Mike.
It's great to have you on.
Great. Thank you. It's my honor and my pleasure to speak here. My title is professor of electrical engineering at University of Texas at Arlington, and my research for the past 15 years has been focused on MEMS fabrication, and we target biomedical applications. The MEMS stand for micro electro mechanical system. Micro means small, so they are very small, and the usual size is smaller than the diameter of a human hair. Electro means electrical, so they can be controlled by electrical signal, such as a computer or cell phone. Mechanical means they are movable. They can move or be moved. Usually they are three-dimensional structure. And S is not plural. S means system. And system means integration. So usually in a MEMS device, it will include some sort of a sensing mechanism and actuation mechanism. That means that the device can sense the environment and do something. And usually they are integrated with integrated circuits, with software, with firmware, as an intelligent identity. MEMS device, although sounds new, but is actually not. Let me give you two examples that we use every day with MEMS device. And I bet every one of the audience out there has MEMS device right now. One is airbag sensor. When you are driving, there's an airbag sensor or several of them in your car. The airbag sensor is a MEMS device that can sense sudden acceleration. Another one is a gyroscope, MEMS gyroscope, or something we call accelerometer in your smartphone. So when you change the orientation in your smartphone, you rotate it, you want to read it differently, And the screen will change with the orientation of your iPhone or your iPad. And that's because inside the iPhone or iPad or smartphone, there's a MEMS device that can sense the orientation of the device. So MEMS device has been made it to our daily life.
Yeah, and it's, I guess it's been in practical use for, has it been the last decade or the last couple of decades that this has began to come into general usage?
I would say last decade, because the reason I was in this research field is that when I graduated from college, from National Taiwan University in 1988, I read an article in Time magazine, and the cover story is about a MEMS device that is so small you can fit a red blood cell into a rotor and examine each red blood cell. So from then, I developed an interest into the MEMS device field. So when I was studying for my PhD, I used a MEMS device for radio frequency system. So I think of the MEMS device, after about 10 years of study in the research field, and suddenly, because they are so unique and provide a novel functionality, they start making into the practical application. Many people said the next big application is the pressure sensor in the tire of your car. So in the future, inside the tire, there will be multiple sensor that can sense your tire pressure continuously and in real time. Many MEMS devices now make their application into medical application, for example, making small surgical tool, and that can operate on vessel or nerves directly. So I think MEMS now is ready into practical and cost-effective application.
Yeah, and, you know, when I think about how these things are manufactured, I always go back to microelectronics and integrated circuits and think, well, you know, very limited understanding of this is that it's made through a process called photolithography and etching, and that's I understand that's how MEMS are created. And I was wondering if you could just spend a couple of minutes describing that fabrication process, if you will.
That's a great thing about MEMS device, because the fabrication and manufacturing process didn't really start from scratch. They utilize, most of the researchers utilize the existing manufacturing process. The photolithography process for integrated circuit is making a multi-layer of material on a single wafer. Wafer is like a carrier, usually is silicon, and the integrated circuit fabrication deposit multiple layer of material, such as silicon and silicon dioxide, and also metal, like making a cake, layer by layer by layer. The major difference between integrated circuit and MEMS device is, in MEMS device, because eventually we want to make it a three-dimensional mechanical structure. So when we are deposit material, we will purposely deposit some material that can be sacrificed. And those sacrificed material is called sacrificial layer. The sacrificial layer is there to occupy space. But in the end of the process, the whole chip, the whole wafer will be dipped into something that can etch away those sacrificial layer. The sacrificial layer, currently most of them are using silicon dioxide, which is glass. And if you put it into a HF solution, hydrofluoric acid solution, then the glass will be etched away. After the sacrificial layer is removed, there will be space among silicon structure that make the silicon structure start to move. That's how you make the movable devices on top of the silicon wafer.
Yeah.
And now the scientists and researchers are exploring multiple material. For example, like us, we are using metal on metal. So we use one metal as the sacrificial layer and the other metal as the structure layer. Some people using polymer, which is plastic, using one polymer as sacrificial layer, the other polymer as mechanical structure. And this way, now we can vary the device characteristics using different material. And the creativity now, of course, is unlimited. Many people are trying, many researchers are trying to put together multiple material and multiple structure to make the devices more complicated and more integrated.
Yes, and you know, the fascinating thing that brought me to you was reading a little synopsis of a recent discovery that was in your lab regarding micro windmills and energy generation. And I was thinking, wow, I mean, this has a lot of potential, especially for portable energy generation, as exemplified in that article regarding using micro windmills to generate cell phones. And I could expand on that. Because it, to my fault or to the fault of those who designed those huge windmills that, you know, create wind power and stuff, and we have a lot out in West Texas, as you know, and I was thinking, how can you make this portable? How could you, like, say, develop this to put it in millions of tiny windmills, to put it in any sort of device, let's say like a car, like a solar powered and now wind powered vehicle that, as you're, you know, let's say a scenario, as you're driving down the road and you're being powered not only, let's say, by solar cells on top of the roof, but let's say by also wind power generated, let's say, as the aerodynamics of the wind swoop down on the back of your car and come back through the trunk like a spoiler, so to speak, and feed into a sort of a grid or I guess, multi-layered grid of these windmills that catch the wind coming out of the back of that. And you've got the potential for some pretty significant energy generation on the road and making it quite portable.
We thought about the windmill, micro-scale windmill idea was that from a thought I had a long time ago, is that can we integrate the windmill on the integrated circuit? If we do, then they might have a lot of application. Our purpose is not to replace the giant windmill that can harvest a lot of energy to power up air conditioner or refrigerator. Our micro windmill can never do that. On the contrary, the reason we are thinking about small is, can we borrow the low-cost manufacturing process to make many of them? Because when they are small, they can be make thousands or if not millions of them with a low-cost price.
Yeah.
So we are trying to reduce the price in order to make the windmill become a more affordable solution for almost every house, every person, per se.
Yes, yes. Price parity, so to speak. Bringing
yes.
the price of alternative energy down to or below the price of fossil fuels.
Yes. Also, we are also thinking that this device can be used on portable electronics or remote sensor. And in those applications, the price really is a key point. If you are going to put the environmental monitor everywhere around the house, building, bridges, airplane, cars, you need to have a power source that is cost effective.
Mm.
For now, America is suffering for infrastructure degradation, and we need to monitor our highway,
yes.
monitor roads, monitor bridges.
Yes.
And it's very costly to put electricity to those places. So if we can integrate a solar panel with a wind turbine into a very small cost-effective sensor in order to continuously monitor those structures, then that can save a lot of money.
Yes, very important point as far as monitoring infrastructure, and especially, you know, within the recent things that have happened in the last, oh, 3 or couple of years regarding bridges. That is a very important point to put out there. And not, you know, this is another one of these beautiful things that is like a seed in the sense that it is has a broad number of applications that we haven't even begun to think about, not only in energy and biotechnology, which unfortunately we neglected to mention because of the short amount of time, but a whole number of ideas with regarding monitoring infrastructure and buildings and integrating that into the architecture.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's unfortunate that we have run out of time. I think, you know, we've got just about of a minute left, and I would leave that to you, to put out any sort of closing thoughts or anything, any sort of message that you want to put out there.
I'm very honored you invited me, give me a chance to chat with you. And I think in a university, a lot of time we are working on fundamental science, physics, and we didn't have a chance to talk to the public, to make the society learn about what we are doing. And so I really appreciate this great opportunity that we have a chance to express our research topic to the general public. And also, by the way, that I have a lot of high school students working in my lab, so it's not probably, most of people think that university research is only for PhD, and a lot of high school students actually working in my lab on their project. So I think I would take this chance to tell the audience that if you have some new ideas, and if you have children who is interested in science and engineering, don't hesitate and pick up the phone or send an email to university professor. A lot of professors are welcome students to come and learn, do more science projects.
Very important point, because, you know, science moves forward, and we need to endow the next generation with the new ideas that are coming up and let them expand on it. And JC, it's been my pleasure having you on today. And, you know, we got to have you on again for further discussion. Hope you'll come on again.
Oh, sure. Yes, anytime. And thank you very much for this opportunity.
And thank you for coming on, and we will see you sometime in the future.
Great. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Thank you.